I'm Rachel Otwell, arts and culture reporter for NPR Illinois.
And I'm Kyle Isham. You're listening to our podcast, Heartland.
I was always struck by the beauty of the Buddhist temples. I was also struck by the mystery of why monks and nuns, why they give up their regular lives. They give up family, they give up career, they give up all sorts of entertainment in order to devote themselves to this practice. So I've always been quite curious why that should be. What do they get in return?
Coming up, a conversation with James Kingsland. He's been a science and medical journalist for 25 years and writes for The Guardian. His new book is called Siddhartha's Brain, Unlocking the Ancient Science of Enlightenment.
Also, we have a postcard for you from a holistic fair that recently took place on the Illinois State Fairgrounds in Springfield.
And we talked to artist Wendy Allen from Springfield and her fellow artist and friend of 40 years, Carol Bridges. The recent art show was named after a Rumi poem and highlights sacred geometry and the forms of the divine feminine.
All that and more ahead. So, Kyle?
Yes, Rachel.
We got in the car together and headed to the fairgrounds.
Yes, it was a very beautiful day.
And it was the 7th annual holistic fair that has happened there, I'm pretty sure.
Correct.
And so I had in mind, I'd never been before, and we were joking a lot about
yes.
how I was super excited for crystals because I like shiny things.
Yeah, there were some stars and glimmers in your eyes for sure.
I definitely wanted to add to my collection, and I was not disappointed. There were lots of crystals on display, including some that went for a lot of money.
A lot of money.
Like a lot of money. Like I didn't even want to be in the presence of these in case something were to happen to them. I was not worthy. And that was kind of the, you know, dichotomy of walking into something that's all about being spiritual, but also about materialism in a way, right?
Yeah, and we talked some then on the ride home about aspects of spiritual materialism that, you know, there's nothing wrong with having this connection with a crystal, but because of the nature of the mind, it can easily turn into a very addictive process where instead of, you know, really connecting and having something that helps alleviate stress or anxiety in your life, suddenly it's a compulsion and you're on eBay at 1 a.m. Not that I would ever know.
So we went and we talked to a variety of people. We talked to, and I guess really we can just play the postcard and let people hear.
Yeah, we'll send you this postcard right now.
All right. First, you're going to hear from Carly Matamore. She is playing a drum made by David Johnston.
Here that was created by David. There's a cowhide here from Africa, and he creates these drums and actually takes a lot of drums and rebuilds them. And I have bought a drum from him before, and it has been the best drum I've ever had.
Hi, I'm Gloria Ferguson. I'm a teaching Reiki master, and we're here to allow other people to experience Reiki that have not done that before. Reiki is life force energy. It's something that puts a person into a deep state of relaxation where healing can take place. And so it's one of those things that you have to experience.
Terry Sacaro of a small business called Lady Hawk's Crystal Rainbow. We don't have a physical shop at this time. I live in Sherman, Illinois, do a lot of work in Springfield. And I've been working with crystals since the 80s. I was just drawn to clear quartz first, and I actually can feel the vibrations. And what I really like to do is help people that have pains in different areas of their body, or if their chakras are not aligned, then I can put the stones on. And I also do Reiki. I'm a second degree Reiki, and I do Reiki and the crystals together. If you use your receiving hand, which is usually your left, and you hold it for a while, you can actually feel a subtle vibration if you're sensitive to it. And I was just very sensitive. There's some stones I can't even hold very long.
And so obviously, this happened in central Illinois, which is part of the reason we're calling the show Heartland. And as such, it can be hard for people to find spiritual communities.
Yeah, and one man we talked to, he had just been at a holistic fair in Cincinnati, and he said it was the size of three buildings that we were in, and it was completely full. And that's what I think really meant the most to me about this experience, was this is an opportunity for people to get to connect with one another and have a chance to feel maybe not so marginalized, or to feel like they're out on the fringes of whatever path they're on, that there are others who share these common interests as them.
And we came across one very interesting individual, and we're going to play a little bit of the conversation we had with that woman, and she's from Peoria.
My name is Buddha Strauss. I am a clairvoyant psychic medium. What that means is I communicate with loved ones that have crossed over to the other side. How I get my information is I see spirits, I hear them, I always physically feel how the person passed. So as an example, let's say Grandpa Joe had a heart attack, I'll start getting those sensations in my body. What makes me a little bit different than other people that do readings is I focus not only on mediumship, but I also communicate with your angels, your spirit guides, any loved ones that happen to come through, any past lives that I see, so that you can kind of utilize everything going on with you to have the best experience possible. When I do a reading, I specifically focus on a blessing and a healing taking place for the person. I don't focus on negative things during my reading. I don't know when people are going to die or anything like that. I don't want to know that stuff. Everything that I do is specifically designed to uplift and help people through whatever transition it is for the reason that they're setting down in front of me.
When did you find people who you could relate to?
That was not until I made the Indigo Way. I consistently tried to seek out people. I've studied all types of different religions, Catholicism, Buddhism, Hinduism. And never quite found that niche. And as an indigo, I've always kind of felt out of place in this world. And indigo is a new age kid. Well, they were born starting right around 1978, some before that, that were brought here to kind of be the movers and shakers, or to bulldoze things out of the way to make way for new age things. So to get rid of dogmatic ideas, what that means is people like me do not in any way, shape, or form like injustices. Like, I'm the type of person that if I saw somebody getting mugged, I wouldn't think, I would just stop it. Or people getting picked on, I don't like things like that. Indigos typically are very bullheaded. They have a lot of sensitivities. They're extremely psychic, empathic. And usually if a parent has an indigo kid, they'll act older than what they are. Like, if you have a 5-year-old, they'll probably get along with 10-year-olds better than other 5-year-olds.
And so you were saying you had to start this Indigo Way place to start to meet other people that you could relate to?
Not to meet other people that I could relate to, but to forge a community in Peoria so other people like me and other like-minded people would have a safe place to learn and grow and to become more spiritual.
What is spirituality to you?
True spirituality to me is everything. It's everything and nothing. Like, there's not one way that's right. Like, Christianity isn't right, Buddhism isn't right, Hinduism isn't right, paganism isn't right. I believe as humans, we all evolve and change. Even our DNA structures do. So to sit there and try to grasp onto one certain way of life, I think is a little bit redundant and foolish.
And so that also kind of goes back to something we talked about in the first episode, that we want to focus on being this sense of community and the fact that you don't have to have a certain specific religion or spiritual practice to want to have that sort of community. I think Buddha kind of spoke to that.
Yeah, definitely. And I like that by following her own path, she's then been able to forge these connections in her life. She spoke to us about how she was working at Caterpillar at one point in her life. And so I think this is always, one of the most fascinating parts of someone who really engages in the spiritual aspects of their life, is that they find a way to forge these connections that then have more meaning in their life and that feel more in tune with who they are as a human individual.
Kyle, obviously for both of us, art is something that we're interested in. You have the studio show.
Correct.
It was recently profiled in the Illinois Times, which you can look up if you haven't seen that yet. And I'm an arts and culture reporter. I'm someone who's always been drawn to music and visual art, dance, just that sort of expression. It's nice. I mean, that's the kind of thing that it's nice to have a community for. I mean, community theater, for instance. I grew up in that. So we ended up going to see an art show.
Yes, at the Pharmacy.
And that's an artist collective. What was much different about this show is it was profiling just two women, one of which is a member at the Pharmacy. And I was really excited for this show. Wendy Allen is the local artist who's the Pharmacy member. And for a few years now, she has been creating these pieces where she collects recycled materials and with them creates brand new, beautiful things. I don't want to go too far into it because we'll get a little more into what it looks like. But you've been meeting lots of artists recently. And I know we've talked about how one person leads to another, and it's almost like this interconnected web.
Yes, definitely.
And it's also kind of, have you seen anyway, you're also in touch with the Trailhead Healing Arts Center. We talked to Justina, who founded that in our last episode.
Yes.
Do you see that people who are into art also happen, you know what I mean? Like, does it seem to intersect at all?
Yeah, I think there's art and spirituality are both kind of rising up from that same place inside of us. There's that language of the unconscious that speaks, and people can either interpret that through art or through spiritual means. And sometimes they're completely woven together.
And what do you mean when you say the language of the unconscious?
This would be the same kind of language that arises in dreams. It's of a symbolic nature. It speaks in metaphor. And by this, when things aren't made so concrete and literal, we have a chance to kind of come into deeper nuances that free us from the ordinary and mundane aspects of our life. It has a very uplifting quality when we engage in these energies.
That makes sense to me, where it's both spirituality and art are places where you can be expressive without having to have like a concrete answer. Like the best artists are the ones who say, I don't know what it means.
Yeah.
You tell me, right?
Yeah, and I think that's one thing that I think can become a trap in spirituality or in art when it's like, okay, well, tell me what this means. Then that rational part of our mind wants to come in and get a very concrete and specific answer. It's more, a question is like a beautiful journey, and it's something that is meant to be explored and experienced. It isn't an answer in a literal way.
And so you and I went to the Pharmacy as they were finished setting up, but we were there right before their first show. So I was blown away just walking into the space. It was, if you were just to like spin around and try to take it in, it would be full of color and glitter almost. You know?
Yes, it was very vibrant, bright. It had a quality of that same kind of feel of being in a dream, because there are these archetypes that are present in each of their work. And so that really touches deeply upon our inner being.
Carol herself has created her own tarot deck, for instance. So there's definitely a lot of symbology that translates into her artwork. So we're going to let them explain their work a little bit. As we mentioned at the beginning of the show, is named after a Rumi poem. It was called Draw Near, was the name of the show. And both artists, Wendy Allen and Carol Bridges, who's from Nashville, Indiana, both of them focus on the divine feminine. And that's not the total of their work, but it's a large part of it.
Yes.
So we'll play a part of the conversation that we actually facilitated between them. We wanted them to just talk as friends, so we'll play a little bit of that here.
What we as women really know is how to attend to this daily life and how to take care of what needs to be taken care of and to respond to the whole.
Right. Again, it's just a further step of understanding that spirituality and earth life are not separate. We've been taught that these things are separate experiences. Well, they're not, you know. Your spirituality has to come into your daily life. And so that helped me to see, then my house is sacred, my room is sacred, my whether I'm washing the dishes or doing the laundry or...
Yeah, because when you really are responding and living out of that sacredness, then everything seems to go in some kind of a flow, and the mind can step out of the way, and it can our life can unfold organically, and suffering drops off.
Yeah.
There's an intuitive sense of the immense beauty and light that we really are. And so then there's this effort to try to capture that in the piece of art. And it's almost like capture an aspect of the divine. Then if we do that, then people will see, hopefully the viewer will then see that that's their reality.
Both those women would tell you that they're deeply spiritual people. And they even, Wendy led a talk about the intersection of art and spirituality before, in anticipation of the show. And they also deal with sacred space, is what they call it, feng shui. Personally, I really like that, the whole idea that what's generally thought of as women's work, the domestic, can be this meaningful thing.
Yeah, because this is how we live our lives. It's not that we have to be having these peak experiences where we're in some ecstatic state, like flying through the air. That's not what we're meant to be doing as humans on this earth. We can do something like mow the grass or just spend time with our children, and that brings out beauty and meaning and a certain gracefulness to our actions.
And if you're like these ladies, you can also, in the meantime, create hundreds of beautiful pieces of art, which we will have a gallery of. We took a lot of pictures while we were there. Wendy's work, they both deal with textiles. Wendy's work is mostly mandalas, and she talks a lot about sacred geometry, which is very interesting and very obvious in her work. And there was even more art going on. Timothy Donovan Russell makes ambient music, and he had done a site specific for this art show music as well as visuals that went with that. And then we stepped outside and went into a small building. And what did we find, Kyle?
This was designed by Sherry Miller, a local artist and space designer. And so when you walked in, there was sod laid out all over on the ground, and it had the most incredible smell. It had been a very sunny day, and so a lot of heat had been building up inside. And there were tree limbs and ferns, and then there was a sand display in the center, kind of making an altar. And so maybe people, even hearing the word sacred space, they associate that then there has to be some devotion to some godhead or creator figure. It's not about that at all. It's more like what Rachel said, to have this place where you can come and be nourished, and you can set aside the more troubling aspects of your thoughts and just daily stresses of life and be renewed and recharged.
This is the Heartland Podcast. I'm Rachel Otwell with my co-host here, Kyle Isham, and we've just been talking about a art exhibit in Springfield that we attended that dealt with sacred space. And I think this actually is a really great segue, because for a lot of people, if they were to make that sort of space, even if it's just your own bed and clearing a space, that's fine too. But lots of people would use that to meditate, right?
Yes.
And that brings us to James Kingsland, and he was someone we were very excited to be able to interview. He is a science editor for The Guardian over there in England.
Merry old England.
Yes, all the way from the cornfields to London. But he joined us on the phone, of course. Unfortunately, it wasn't in our budget to fly there.
Maybe next year, though. We're crossing our fingers.
Yep, we're putting that intention out into the world.
Yes, with crystals at our forehead as we speak it.
At least we can be humorous, right?
Yes.
It's not all. Spirituality isn't all that.
Yeah, you have to have a sense of humor and playfulness, because otherwise it becomes absurd in a really bad way.
So James Kingsland wrote a book that was just recently released, and it's called Siddhartha's Brain, Unlocking the Ancient Science of Enlightenment. And as someone who has covered science as a journalist, he not only takes a historical look at it, going all the way back to talking about who Siddhartha was in the first place, but he brings it into modern times and looking at neuroscience and how meditation actually physically can change the brain.
I've been on holiday in Thailand a few times. The first time was about 10 years ago, and I was always struck by the beauty of the temples, of the Buddhist temples. I was also struck by the mystery of why monks and nuns, they give up their regular lives. They give up family, they give up career, they give up all sorts of entertainments. About 5 years ago, a friend of mine introduced me to a Thai Buddhist temple right here in London. It was almost on my doorstep, so I was amazed. So I started to get really curious. And about this time, I started reading up about mindfulness meditation. I was struck by the parallels between Buddhist teaching and modern mindfulness therapy. So, you know, that was extraordinary, this practice that goes back 2,500 years. Psychologists are using it essentially pretty much unchanged in their clinics to treat people suffering from addiction, depression, anxiety, chronic pain. So, I was taken aback. So I carried on investigating, and the book is the result.
How could an introspective practice like meditation lead one away from the kind of tyranny of self-absorption and isolation that we see so greatly affecting our modern culture today?
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because I was on holiday. I was lucky enough to be on holiday in Venice last week for just a couple of days. And as you know, it's perhaps the most beautiful and magical city in the world. It's a treasure. And I was watching these other tourists taking rides in gondolas. All they seemed to be intent on doing was filming themselves on their smartphones. And I found this absolutely extraordinary, that here they were in the most beautiful, magical city on earth. All they were thinking about was, how can I make this look on Facebook to the folks back home, you know? Rather than being in the moment and enjoying the wonders of Venice, they were focused on what was essentially self-promotion. And no, don't get me wrong, I'm as susceptible to this as anybody else. I was there with my camera. But I did find it curious that as a species, we're so obsessed with ourselves and with promotion, self-promotion, we're not really present to enjoy the beauty and fascination that's all around us. So transcending the self, that egotism, is one of the things that meditation achieves.
So obviously you have a very grounded background in science, and spirituality and science have generally traditionally been viewed as adversarial. How do you hope to break down this dichotomy?
Well, the way I see it, spirituality, going on a spiritual quest, is when it comes down to it, is really it's a quest for optimum mental well-being. You don't need to be a religious person to meditate. You don't need to believe in a creator God or subscribe to a creed to get the benefits from it. But where spirituality is concerned, I think doctors and psychologists are coming around to the view that people on a spiritual journey are simply looking for better mental health. They're looking for a way to transcend themselves and to connect with everybody else.
And so what is mindfulness to you then?
Mindfulness is a way of focusing on the present moment, on what's actually happening right here, right now, but without any sense of judgment or elaboration. You need to be compassionate to yourself when you're being mindful. For me, mindfulness, I've been practicing for the past 5 years. I've still got a long way to go, but when I take the trouble to stop and practice, for example, paying attention to my breath, it brings a sense of peace, and it's kind of a way to reboot the mind and to restart on a fresh page.
And I'm sure the book gets more into this, but can you talk a little bit about your own personal practice when it comes to meditation? Is it something that you find to be a spiritual practice?
It's absolutely a spiritual practice, yes. I mean, I used to be a Christian, and many of the benefits that I used to get from going to church, being part of a congregation, I find I have the same benefits from mindfulness and meditation, that increased sense of connection with other people, of feeling of less isolation. So mindfulness can do that. I try to practice for half an hour a day after breakfast. I get down on the floor, cross-legged, and I concentrate on my breath. And it's a way of focusing before the day starts. I mean, some of these monks, they've been meditating for tens of thousands of hours over several decades. And so I couldn't possibly comment on that, on their experience. But I could say for myself that it's been a terrific benefit. I feel calmer, less angry, less stressed. And that's not to say that, you know, I don't suffer from those emotions. Everybody does. But I feel as though I have a tool for coping with it now, which I didn't have before.
Given our own mind's propensity for moving towards extremes, how does a practice like mindfulness not just become another obsession or something that is riddling the mind and sabotaging the very thing it claims to be moving towards?
Well, that's a very good point. With mindfulness, you always have to be wary that you're not becoming obsessed with it in the same way that we're obsessed with everyday thoughts, and we become attached to our ideas, our opinions, our views. And if we're not careful, mindfulness can become just another attachment, just another obsession. I mean, if you're doing it right, you're letting go of all that sort of thing. You're simply you're learning to be rather than constantly do. You're letting go rather than clinging. Mindfulness is all about getting rid of obsession.
I think a lot of times there is then that tendency to think, well, I'm going to get rid of all ambition. It's just all bad, and so therefore I can't touch any of it. Instead of, you know, you had to write this book, so that took clear-cut goals and to have a certain sense of purpose.
That's right,
and direction.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. There's this misconception that to become mindful, to take meditation seriously, is almost like becoming a monk and not wanting anything. But even monastics, even monks and nuns, have goals in life. They have spiritual goals. They have ambition. Maybe they're not quite the same as the ambitions of the rest of us. But I think the key really is not to cling to those things. I had a wonderful conversation with the abbot of a Buddhist monastery here. I explained to him that I was writing a book, and he gave me a really good piece of advice. He said, maybe your book will be a big success, and that's terrific, but don't become intoxicated by that success. And on the other hand, your book might be a flop. Well, don't become obsessed by that either. So go ahead and write your book, but don't cling to either success or failure.
With the book, are you looking at all at ways that meditation does physically change the brain at all?
Yes, that's right. Yes, a large part of the book is reviewing neuroscience, the findings about, for example, about changes in the thickness of the cortex in certain key parts of the brain, about changes in activity in particular parts of the brain. There's plenty of neuroscience in there. It's a curious book. It's got some religion, got some philosophy, and it's got quite a lot of hard science as well. So I hope it's an interesting combination for people.
And so that was James Kingsland. He was talking to us about his book, Siddhartha's Brain. Siddhartha, of course, being Buddha to many. And that book is about unlocking the ancient science of enlightenment. It just came out in April.
What I loved about what James had to say is that he is a very rational man, and he even stresses that and accents that when he came to this, there was a kind of skepticism. It wasn't that he was just suddenly awash in this philosophy. He still has that background being a journalist and studying science. So he's a very grounded individual. And he mentioned how his mind would become very active because of his job, having to do a lot of research, which, you know, then activates all of those neurons in our brain. And so he needed a way to kind of step back from that. And I think that's so important in our modern world, because we are all very overstimulated by all of the technology we have. And so we need to find ways to then take not only a step back, but then have perspective on all of these things so that we don't become addicted to them.
Also, I like the idea that meditation isn't about just one part of your day that you finally take to be relaxed, but it's about changing the way you process everything to where you can calmly go about life. Obviously, many of us have high stress jobs. We're trying to juggle that along with family life and taking care of the home and band practice for your kids and soccer and all these other things. where meditation can help you really kind of gain control over the thought processes that you have or learn how to relinquish the control you're striving to have.
Yeah, and that's what I think is so important. It brings awareness to know when you need to let go and when you need to engage, because so much I think people are looking for a formula, because then it lets one off the hook of having to engage in life, because everyone is very stressed and overworked and has so many things in their life that needs their attention. So the kind of adverse effect of that is that then people start tuning out. What James had found is that this was something that helped him actually engage more, and that the essence of what mindfulness was to him is a practice that allows you to have that level of engagement so that you aren't using meditation as a kind of spiritual escapism, which is very tempting to the mind.
And so we like to end the show with some music. Last time it was a poem, but something lovely just to leave our listeners with. And at this point, it's a little bit of old news, but I don't think anyone is quite...
Wait, you're hearing it right now for the first time by
news.
Rachel Otwell.
Indeed.
Listen up.
Yep. I'm personally still not over the fact that Prince is departed. However, I have been using this opportunity to absorb more and more of his music. He's one of those figures who's like become an icon. Like when Bowie died, it was the same thing, I think, for a lot of people, where it's almost more the idea of the man that everybody has created in their mind than the actual, you know. There was a lot of, I actually wrote about the fact that after David Bowie died, people were talking about all his misdeeds, which I just gave air quotes to, but talking about him having sex with underage groupies and the fact that the Thin White Duke could have been construed as racist and these different things. But it was almost as like people were shocked that he was human.
Yeah, and I think that's such a disservice in our life, that we don't allow the human expression, or we are always trying to make benediction for those parts.
Prince and Bowie, I mean, it's really easy to put them in the same sentence just because they both lived outside the binary when it came to sexuality, when it came to gender. They waved their freak flag high and they were proud of it. And I think for a lot of people who felt like outsiders for whatever reason were able to, you know, pick these very visible people out of pop culture and say, hey, they're speaking to me. They're talking to people like me. I was interested in learning more about Prince's spirituality. I have been finding out things now.
What have you found out?
Well, I hadn't realized that later in life he converted to being a Jehovah's Witness, for instance. And of course, early in the 80s, when he was first coming on the scene, lots of people either assumed that he was gay or bi. He was definitely someone who was not afraid of having that label tagged on to him, though many say that he was quite fond of the ladies specifically. But he was just into sex in general, let's face it, right? But later in life, you know, that was not part of his identity that he really wanted to celebrate anymore, what I've read.
Okay.
And so it's interesting how identity is so flexible and fluid, and
yes,
how it's changed for him. And you had a quote that we were talking about earlier,
yeah,
about these sort of iconoclasts people, these idols in our culture, and I'd love for you to share that.
Okay, so this is from Liz Green's book called The Astrological Neptune. And she is an astrologer, but she also does therapeutic work, and she studied psychiatry. So she has a very rich and diverse background. So beyond just astrology, she really gets into the essence of what being alive is all about. And so here is her quote on glamour. "We need glamour because it transports us into the mythic world, where colors are brighter, feelings are more intense, and life has a quality of luminosity and beauty which compensates for the dreariness and difficulty of ordinary daily surroundings and survival. Without glamour, our souls hunger and thirst, and without glamorous people, we have no mirror in which to perceive the dim outlines of our own deepest archetypal longings."
And I love that. And anytime anyone makes fun of me for liking pop music, I'm going to read that.
Now you got something heavy to hit back with.
Yeah, it's deeper than you think. No, but I really do love that. And we thought we would go out here on a Prince song. What better than to play But Controversy, where he asks, you know, am I black? Am I white? Am I straight or gay? He's throwing those questions out. And for whatever reason, the Lord's Prayer is also a part of this song.
Which, you know, you might as well throw it in there.
Yep. For a long time, he has been someone who, at the same time he was waving his freak flag, he was also a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just life, I guess, right?
Yeah, that's the complexity of life. That is something really fascinating and beautiful.
So here it is. Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much.
Controversy. see.